responsible for the program. Actually, he doesn't have any power because he is black, unquote. And he goes on to say that if the program works, it will be a great success for the administration. If it fails, it will all be blamed upon Shelley. Oh, well. Williams then made some comment to the effect that the point of these meetings was to get difficulties out into the open so we could begin to work on them. There must have been a gap in there because it doesn't really follow from what we've just been talking about. Anyway, I turned right on him and said, okay, now you've known since Monday at the AAUP meeting that there were all black sections out there when they weren't supposed to be. Now, what are you doing about that? And the answer was that even for the 175 in the one psych section that where they're having a lecture instead of the TV lecture, nothing has been done. By Williams, anyway. And maybe not by anyone. Okay. Now, Morrison, at this point, we were discussing the fragmentation of the bureaucracy, of course, the business about admissions not knowing what financial aids is doing, not knowing what the program looks like, and so on. Morrison then made the comment that this fragmentation of the administration, this inability to have anybody in charge of anything, is exactly what we see all the time at the university. That last fall, we got the university to agree to open up its facilities this summer to kids from the North End, and that he and Kenny Allen begged them to put someone in charge of this program to see that, in fact, it would be carried out, and that they never did that, and that as a consequence, it was students, and I guess it turned out to have been Mel Reif, who this summer arranged for that actually to happen. So that, as usual, the decision is made to do something, but no one ever conveys this decision down to the people who would, in fact, carry it out. Williams went on to say that the chancellor took over a leaky old boat. We had to realize that there were really more things he could possibly get to in a year. Morrison then immediately interjected with, that's all very fine and good, except look at the kind of people he has around him and presumably is using as advisors and as staff people. And he pointed out that we had gone to, there must have been something connecting this up. Well, I don't know if this is exactly the point where these things got said, but I'll say them. That the attitude around here has been to cool our difficulties, to not even realize that we have them, to cover them up as much as possible. We spend so much time doing that, we never cure the difficulties. I guess that was basically his point. He pointed out, this I do have in my notes, that he and I went to JWP in early June and asked for a letter to parents, which, as Bruce characterized it, would explain to them what the program was all about and kind of prepare them for the difficulties which we knew we would have. That's sort of the end of his quote. He said that the chancellor vetoed this because he feared negative reaction out in the state. He feared that the Neanderthals would come out from under their rocks if the more they knew about the program, and that the safest thing was to keep them in ignorance. This is in congruence with my recommendation, with my recollection of the situation, except for one detail, which is that the letter wasn't really a letter to parents explaining the program. It was more presented to the chancellor as a promotional thing for the Martin Luther King Fund, that we would keep the pitch for money low key and make it look informational. And I'm not sure that there was a whole lot of discussion about preparing a base of support in the state. We were primarily after money at that point, and I think that was the point of the letter. The business about the reason for the chancellor not paying for that letter, which was why we went to see him, holds. He was afraid of more negative reaction than positive. Now then, Millett, Morrison got pointing out how the administration has been trying to make us cool it, that in fact cool it is always the message. This was the message in June when we wanted to send this letter out to the parents, and it's the message now when, for example, last Tuesday morning Millett came up to him and said, what are you doing holding this rally at 2 o'clock this afternoon? Don't you realize you could blow up the whole university that way? He hoped Morrison could control the crowd, and so on. It was at this point that I said, did Millett now at this time, Tuesday morning, was he yet ready to admit that any of his bureaucracy had failed and that, in fact, there was anything substantively wrong about either financial aids or housing? And so far as anybody knows, he was still trying to explain things away at this hour, Tuesday morning, and was not admitting any mistakes. Now, Addison made a point here that the university never admits it's a mistake, that it's powerful, doesn't want to lose that power, that it has the power of the media. The PIO puts out the chancellor's point of view and nobody else's. Someone at this point read into the record for that in all fairness, the BSA statement had been issued by the PIO office, so that was not true, that it only represented the chancellor's position. However, Addison said that the university won't admit its guilt and it will always try to clobber people like the BSA who have no power and who are vulnerable since they have no access to the press. And he said that he would go on and get the press as much as possible. Dan Perino argued with him, saying, why are you doing that? I mean, can't you really have any faith and so on in the system? And he didn't get very far. Now, someone else pointed out that if the administration were trying to inflame us, they couldn't have done a better job. For example, putting up the signs that the union would close at 7 o'clock at 1:55, right before the 2 o'clock meeting last Tuesday. Now, Cornett made the remark here that he was really afraid of the wolf bait issue. He was quite sure that not only were they getting us to cool it, but they were going to fire some kids. In other words, that they're buying us off and then they'll sell us down the river. He saw it as a policy of escalation, and it was bugging him very much. At this point, Morrison raised the point that Metzger, indeed, is making policy instead of advising in the disciplinary referral committee hearings, and that he, for one, feels that it's very bad to have Metzger in there. He then went on that about the chancellor listening to incompetent people or people who have gotten him in trouble before, who have not given him the word. And he pointed out that he, Morrison, regardless of the quality of his advice, had not even been able to get it through all of these minor functionaries to the chancellor last Monday evening and Tuesday morning. He was pretty bitter about that. Cornib went on to say that not only is Metzger in there, but there are other problems with the disciplinary system. That in May, he had said to Bentley that he was about to appoint people to the disciplinary, to Committee A, and that Bentley had written back saying that the people who were on that committee had decided to stay on another year, and that we didn't need any more student appointees. But then, Cornib said, with great outrage, in August, a letter apparently went out from Bentley asking these students to remain on the committee for this year. So he doesn't know what's going on. He also went on to say that he was very discouraged about the way the administration had handled him in general, that there's always a no answer, not only with Bentley, but with other people. For example, that he had been fighting with the housing division over a girl's contract. She apparently is paying twice because she signed two contracts or something. He got the answer that there are no exceptions to our rules from Mr. Souter. He feels very frustrated on that one. On the union board, he apparently has been pushing for changes all summer with no success. He pointed out that their idea of compromise, the administration's idea of compromise, is that the students give in. And Morrison at this point said, what does Millett ever pay to get his way? When do they ever give in? What kinds of things do they give up, if anything? Nothing. Cornib said that his perception of it is a vast machinery processing people, that even with this 500 program, we're still treating the kids as if it were a gas station, that here are these kids and we think it's good for them to come and get some of our culture, but that no one had ever thought that maybe they have something to teach us, that it's all very one way. That in fact, that's how all students are treated. They're never taken into kind of any kind of equal partnership. Their roles are always superficial. Now, Williams said, well, this isn't really so, that you have to realize that the faculty, for example, which we're talking about, when we say that people's perception of the place is that of a gas station, that we are teaching the kids the truth, which somehow or other resides in the university, and that the kids have nothing to say, either about the truth or about the way the truth is taught. He pointed out that you do have a big selling job to do internally here, that a classic case of one that was fought for a long time and finally won was that the physical plant people this summer came around and saw what he and the chancellor and some of the other people had been telling them for some time, and that now we have an apprenticeship program going this fall that have 13 out of 50 in it black. He says that we have administrators who must have time to either grow into their job, and if they do not grow in the job, then we kick them out, but that we had to realize it took time. Now, Cornham said that may be, but we had to realize how far back we were starting, and he went on about the union having rules on dress for its employees. They can't have long hair, they must wear socks and their shoes, things of this sort, no beards. Now, Hackman said at this point to Williams, this business about us getting to know each other and having a lot of talking and educating the employees and the administration and the faculty of the university is all very fine and good, except that the outcome of it will be even worse confrontations, because we will discover that these groups do not have the same self-interest, that the students and administrators are really opposed to each other irrevocably, and that all that's what will become clear if they get to know each other better. Now, at this point, Addison got to talking about the enemy, all right, and he told about how he had been arrested in Florida on a framed-up charge and that he had no intention of going into a courtroom ever again where he was guilty before the process began. He said our disciplinary system reminds him of Southern justice, and he was very unhappy over what is going on in there, and says that, in fact, everyone's getting more and more uptight for the last few days, that certainly the chancellor and other people know what Metzger is doing in there, and the charge being made over and over here, you see, is that Metzger is holding out for a very hard line, that someone said that we have on good authority that he dissuaded one of the members of the referral committee from dropping the charges altogether on the grounds of insufficient evidence, and apparently is acting to demand that the cases be sent to Subcommittee A, the harsher, meaning the implication being that it's a more serious thing that's gone wrong, and so on. Now, I asked as a point of information what happens at the referral committee, and I was told that a piece of paper goes through. Basically, they read the case and decide whether or not it should go to A or B. And this was really felt to be very wrong by Morrison, since that you have a prejudgment of guilt if you go to A. They amount to saying that the thing is very serious that you did. He also pointed out that this procedure is against the original guidelines set down by the whole Senate Disciplinary Committee this week, and it's also against the guidelines set down after the Dow demonstration, which said that a special body would be constituted to handle the discipline in instances of mob difficulties of this sort. He also said, what are you doing to the kids in the meantime? They're hanging under this threat of expulsion or worse, and the threat of civil charges actually being carried out, and isn't the situation terrible for them? How could they possibly study? That they may flunk out worrying about their charges. I then asked him how he knew they were so uptight, and he just said it was obvious, and then I said to Addison, well, are they? And he said, yes, they were. On the other hand, as you know, I have it from Ted Brown some days ago that the kids were reasonably relaxed about the charges and had the feeling that the thing would work itself out. So if they're inflamed, it's because they have been inflamed by these words which leak back from people like Cooper and Cornub, who have representatives on these committees and know what's going on in there, to the BSA, where they get upset about it. Okay, now here's where Cooper tells about Metzger and how he's behaving and how he always behaves. He says, Metzger always says that the law says this, or that this is the way it is. And this is where the charge was made, that he caused one of the members of the committee to change his vote for dismissal, of all the things. Metzger, as Morrison charges, making policy while pretending to be an advisor. He's not advising at all. He's definitely giving opinion and tampering with the whole situation. Now, Addison said that this is what discourages him very much, is that only in his conversation with the chancellor a day before yesterday has he felt for the first time that he had some kind of depth of communication with Jack. But now he says he feels sold out again over Metzger and the fact that we've had 18 more arrests in the last 2 days of people who are being charged with this mob action thing. Now, Cornum at this point pushed in that the whole year 1968-69 depends upon this disciplinary procedure, that the kids are being screwed because there are no decent representatives on the committee when they finally get to Committee A, and secondly, Metzger is in there calling for blood. Now, it has been understood, and I don't know half this down on the tape, but it's been understood before from a number of sources that Metzger was asking for serious punishment when they took the whole thing to the state's attorney, I shouldn't say serious punishment, but he wanted a more serious charge than mob action. It also emerged at this meeting tonight, rather earlier than I have mentioned so far, that mob action has been at least in part called unconstitutional, and Addison says that his lawyers coming in on Sunday have the feeling that they can have the whole thing declared unconstitutional. Now, however, I was telling you about what Cornub said, and his objections were that he had no representatives and the Metzger was in there prejudicing the group and fighting for a political position. He then made a remark that if he had to bust the whole machine to get at the arm that was beating him. Well, dot, dot, dot. But he turned right around and said, can't we get out of this policy of escalation where you know, we are just forced in, hopelessly to go on and make things worse and worse? It was at this point that Goss started pointing out to William Williams that something didn't even have to be done because the white students waited. They're just waiting for the blacks, that there could have been a good activity last Tuesday at 6 when that meeting was formed. The whole point of that meeting was to listen to what the black students wanted to do and then join them. Now he says the time is there. Maybe the blacks cooled it last Tuesday, but now is the time. Morrison made a remark rather similar, that he held back. That he could have gotten together all the white students at 3 a.m. after when the blacks were being arrested. There could have been some whites arrested too, and there would have been a white demonstration, but that he cooled it. And Cornib then said, yes, after all, the university insults one's intelligence by playing footsie and with all these little questions of having people appointed to committees and so on. He went on to say that the way the administration deals with him is an insult to his intelligence. He also said at this point, why don't we just come out and make some kind of strong statement, like if the 500 program goes, the entire university goes, that it means that much to us, that that's where it's at. Well, Williams said, from the first place, one thing at a time, the public opinion and the kids' concern and so on hadn't been realized as being so important this week that we were working on money. And he said, the other thing is that it isn't true that if the 500 program goes, the university goes, that a large commitment from the faculty simply hasn't been made. So, Cornib said, that may be all right, but what you're basically doing is saying to us that you have the tool room and you're asking us what you want built, or what we want built. But we're not getting in there to the tool room. We're not helping any. You're always saying you can handle it somehow, but we have no evidence that you can handle it. You've bungled it horribly. Now, Williams then told about how he came here and how hard it is to change things, about how he sat down with union people who were thinking of changing procedures over there, and he asked them innocently if they had, what did the students think about this particular matter, and was looked at aghast, and then said later that it was referred to, and he assured us this was a real situation, as a novel idea when he said that perhaps we ought to involve students in the planning of things. Now, Goss went on, and still emphasizing the cool it role, pointed out that the president almost held up visitation last weekend for fear of the publicity, that they were going to release that thing. Cornib said that the reason for all the kids going to Subcommittee A is because it's very hard to separate the 25 from the 218. I don't know if it's just a metaphor or not, but what everyone said tonight was that basically 25 kids were going to have to burn for this thing. And I don't know why they figured the number 25 or what, but anyway, they do. Well, at this point, it was about 12:30, and Addison said that he couldn't just sit around all night, that he had to take action, that he simply did not trust the university, that the BSA was going to have to take a defensive position, and that meant he had to go talk to his executive committee, and that something had to happen in the morning. He said that they needed to take action because there was a lack of due process and no evidence that there would be any due process at any time soon. At this point, he got up and tried to leave. Well, he was talked to at the door by Dan Prino and Kenny Allen and Mr. Williams, and the rest of us sat around in the room. Now, present in the room were, at the beginning, just John Hackman and Bruce and Jim Goss, Mike Cooper, John Saltiel, Mrs. Williams, and then came in Cornib and a fellow whose first name is Vic Fine, not Berkey, and then after that came in Dave Addison and his wife, and I'm bothered because I've got one person left out. Oh, well, also, of course, Dan Perino and Kenny Allen were there, and Bob Goldstein was there. Okay. So I guess I'd gotten up to the point where Addison left, and that was basically the end of the meeting. Now, then I came back to the house and Bruce went to bed. On the way back, I pointed out to Bruce that although all of his suspicions about Millett and Metzger may be entirely right, nevertheless, we had committed David Addison to a course of action on the basis of incomplete knowledge. We didn't really know what was going on. We didn't really know what the strategy was. He lit into me saying that this was no time to be fancy. I don't know. I didn't really know what he said. But anyway, I think I ultimately made my point that we had a case of mass hysteria this evening where we all talked ourselves into a great big plot on the part of Metzger and Millett. And we had to admit that there was evidence for such a thing, what with these new evidence, with these new people being arrested and with the known role of Mr. Metzger in this session. After that, I went out and had a milkshake with Mel, and we discussed my role in this whole thing and what's going on here. Neither of us is very happy with these latest developments. Mel, however, pointed out to me that I infuriate people by taking any kind of a role other than that of the silent reporter. It is true that Saul Thiel just kept demanding that I shut up several times this evening. He didn't succeed. Bruce basically defended me, but I certainly was enraging him. My tendency to at least point out to them that they don't know exactly what the administration is doing. It's a little early to jump to conclusions, to fill in the brushstrokes with the very darkest paints, is difficult. And I know that. We were talking about what was going on in that room. Certainly that Goss is irresponsible. Morrison is still hung up on what happened to him last Monday night and really does, for lots of reasons, hate and fear Millett and Metzger. Cornyn basically is hard to read, except that he's a fairly sensible guy, and he really does feel caught in the middle. And he does feel as if he has got to make some kind of a stand, that the university cannot sell these kids down the river the way it looks as if they might do. Mel just reminded me that, of course, I have to watch my role, that if I'm the reporter, I can't be interacting. I simply said that I felt I was a better reporter for the interaction, and that, in fact, Mel pointed out that I'm the only person who could take notes in a room like that, and I said, yeah, that may be. You see, as I left, William Williams made the point that he would just as soon not have any of this tied to him, that he hoped that his role would certainly be downplayed if mentioned at all. And I assured him that I had certain sensitivities in this area and that nothing was going to come out of this in a hurry anyway. But Mel's point was that I'm rapidly wearing down the left, that they're not going to be able to take me much longer, and that I have to be very careful how I play my cards in terms of interacting with the group. And I assured him that I was aware of those things, that I was trying not to enrage anyone, but that I just couldn't stand by and watch this escalation, and particularly when it's unnecessary, when they don't have sufficient information and are jumping to conclusions about people and how ominous the situation is, that I was aware of my problem there, but I would do what I could with it. It was Mel's impression of Saul Thiel and company that they are basically fascist personalities. And I think that there's some real possibility there. Norton Long remarked this afternoon that the people at Columbia had no morals, they had no principle, there was no way, no common ground on which one could appeal to a Mark Rudd. And I held out that these people deserved to be argued with, that they was too early to write them off. They really did have shared values with us. He simply wasn't buying any of that. I think Mel is saying basically the same thing about some of the hotheads here. It was perfectly apparent from the way the conversation went tonight that a lot of people, Cornyn, for example, pointed out that the educational reform thing had petered out, that everybody was abandoning us on all fronts, and that the university in many respects didn't deserve to exist. Addison conceded that most of his kids were really interested in staying in the university. They were not at all intent to bring it down, but that the situation at the moment was getting worse and worse, and he felt that they would have to take a defensive, retaliatory posture very soon. So I guess that covers flavor that wasn't in there. Mel told me a couple of other interesting things. We got to talking about Shelley's role in this whole thing, and could he be responsible for some of the problems, and Mel says that he heard Shelley say to Wofford that, in fact, the only time he'd seen Shelley open up much was when he was talking to Wofford, and that he overheard him say to Wofford, they brought me in to do this program, and when I do something, I do it. It's my program. And apparently someone working in Shelley's office says that he's great with the kids, and this seems to be conceded by everyone, but there is this problem of communication with other people and feeling the project is all his. Well, I know the situation he's operating in yet, and I'm not about to buy any simplistic deal. It's important now, I guess, to find out if Morrison ever mentioned the financial difficulties to anyone he called on Monday night trying to get somebody to do something. And I also need to ask the Chancellor when he first realized there exist financial problems. It seems incredible that this fact could have really been kept secret all of August. It is now, it's Saturday the 21st at about 11:15 p.m. I want to make the point here, just from listening to the last few words to find my place in this tape, that there is a dictaphone belt that Morrison made almost on the spot in the Union at no later than, say, 3 or 3:30 or 4 a.m. on Monday, which exists, and that may be one place we can find out about this money thing. I will have other things to add here now. What follows is the discussion of a dinner Friday at the Union. This is Friday the 19th, or maybe the 20th. I called Bruce after having a conversation with Mel Rothbaum about what I might be doing in the next few months, and I found him about to go down to have dinner with Dean West and a couple of other people. And at this dinner, Bruce reconstructed the meeting that had occurred at 12:30 with himself, Addison and Cooper, Shelley, Perino, Millett, Morrison, and Cribbett. Now, Cribbett objected to recording this meeting. Metzger, however, supported the transcript. This was called, apparently, by William Williams. It was called by Dan Perino, who reacted rather strongly to what had gone on at William Williams the night before and apparently asked Stan Millett to set this meeting up. Now, Metzger and Cribbett were the ones who were examined most by the students, who were very concerned about what's going on in the referral committee. Millett and Metzger disagreed on Metzger's role. Millett claimed that Metzger was there to tell the referral committee how it works. But Metzger said that the chancellor asked for a thorough investigation of all the facts to the discipline committee and to Peldison, and that his role had more to do with general advising. Cribbett claimed that Metzger was there to interpret the faculty instructions, this presumably the faculty committee on discipline, and Metzger said he was there to give legal advice to the committee. Now, they discussed the BSA incident a little bit, the one where a white student apparently hung around outside the BSA office and then apparently took a swing at one of their students. Addison said that they took action against black students, but they are not taking action against whites, that there's an asymmetry in here. The chancellor announced, he dropped in very briefly upon this meeting and announced that from now on, police will arrest all lawbreakers regardless of student status. This rescinds the previous discretion which had been left up to the police to perhaps treat students differently from outside people. Now, Morrison had an exchange with the chancellor. He said to the chancellor that he was concerned over a confusion of roles and a conflict of interest of Millett and Metzger, and he pleaded that the chancellor realize that students' perception of these roles is important as what, in fact, they are doing. I don't really know what the chancellor answered to that, if anything. Morrison pointed out to Millett at the same meeting that Millett was claiming that he was totally in control of the situation and knew all available facts, but Morrison pointed out that no one had interviewed him and that he had had a role in it. Millett answered immediately, "Well, we'll send someone right over." But then he turned on Bruce and said, "You have responsibilities. You should be identifying people who did things that were wrong," and so on. Now, Morrison also said now at dinner, he was recounting this to Dean West, Mel Reif, myself, Mike Cooper, I believe he was there. Not sure about that. I'll probably remember who else was there, not that it matters a whole lot. Anyway, Morrison said he wanted to be soothed, but unfortunately he couldn't believe them, that this lunch hadn't been very satisfying. He went back to the lunch and said that Millett and Metzger had argued that they had suspended dismissal in the possible outcome simply for public opinion. Now, apparently the positions of the Chancellor, Metzger, and Millett, as expressed at this luncheon meeting, which Morrison is now recounting here, were that Metzger would definitely send everyone to Subcommittee A. Millett said he would because of the external circumstances in the state, and the Chancellor had the impression that perhaps B would have been the thing he would have done had he been on the committee. Millett was charged that perhaps he was responding to pressure from the state and not from the students. His response was that if they really wanted to ignore students, they could have told the Board of Trustees to have them all tossed out, or recommended that to the board, to have the board recommend that back. This is a typical Millet statement. I'm sure he never in a thousand years considered having them all kicked out. But this, now you see, this can be distorted by people like Vic Berkey if they hear the story. Everyone laughed at this dinner meeting over the fact that Perino and Millet had been so uptight. This was apparently in connection with why the meeting had ever occurred at 12:30 and Dan's having called it. They pointed out that Perino and Millet heard about a snack bar sit-in the other night and apparently called every radical in town to try to head it off and simply succeeded in letting everyone know about it. So that's where it is. Now, Gross claims that... Gross came in at this point and insisted on interacting with the group and informed us that he had just been talking with Millet and Levy and that he had informed them that he didn't think anything more than restitution was necessary and that any punishment for people who damaged things beyond restitution would be wrong, it would be ruining the rest of their lives and that kind of thing. Now then, a gentleman by the name of S.S. came to speak to us upon call, and he gave us a very good picture of what had been going on in the referral committee. Apparently, 9:30 a.m. Tuesday, people on the referral committee were called and told that there was to be an 11 a.m. meeting, and could they make it? When they went to the 11 a.m. meeting, well, in the meantime, apparently, one student member was unavailable, and so Harvey Benenson was called in the Student Senate office and asked to find someone in a hurry to send at 11, and such a person was found. His name is Wayne Herring, or Herring, H-E-U-R-I-N-G. The referral committee consists of John Scoofus as a head, Dean Olson from LAS, I believe, Dean Hill from... Miriam's office, Professor Newman from psychology, Steve Sloan, and Wayne Herring. The